Osho, Tao, the Three Treasures, Volume 1. Talks on Fragments from Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 4.
The first question. Do you know who I am? No, sir, not at all. Because you are not. You are in emptiness. Anatta, no self. On the surface, you may be somebody. But I am not concerned with your surface. In the deepest core, you are simply a nobodiness, not even a nobody. Nobodiness. How can I know you? And that's the beauty. Because if I can know you, I have defined you. I have made you limited by my knowledge. If you can be known, immediately you become an object. You are no more a consciousness. If you can be known, you cannot be infinite. And you are infinite in your emptiness. How can I know you? Even you yourself cannot know. There exists nothing like self-knowledge. When you come to realize it, it is a no self-knowledge. When you come to settle with it, suddenly you become aware that the knower and the known have disappeared. There is only emptiness, a vast space with no beginning, no end, an infinity. That's what you are. How it can be known? There is no possibility of knowledge. And it is good that you cannot be known. Otherwise, science will know you. And once known, you are an object, a thing. Then the mystery is lost. That's why I say again and again that science will be never able to know the innermost core of being. Because the innermost core is a non-being. You are just like an onion. Go on peeling the layers. Go on peeling the layers. A new layer comes, another new layer, and then suddenly the whole onion is gone. Emptiness in the hands. That's you. But this emptiness is not negative. So don't misunderstand me. The very word emptiness looks absence of something. No, it is not. It is presence of something infinite. It is not absence. It is not negative. It is not like darkness. It is a positive phenomena. You are a no self. This positivity has to be remembered. Because the word emptiness may give you a wrong notion about it. You may think it is simply empty. I'm not saying it is empty of something. I'm not saying there is absence of something. No, it is emptiness. The very emptiness it is. Emptiness itself it is. Emptiness is being used as a positive. term. When it is positive, it is totally different. You have known emptiness only in a negative way. You go into the room, there is no furniture, and you say the room is empty. There is nothing. You come out, and if I ask you what you saw in the room, you will say, it is empty, no furniture, no pictures on the walls, nothing, just empty. You went into the room, but you watched only the negative part. The room is filled with roominess that you didn't encounter. A room is emptiness. A room means space. Something can be brought in because there is room. There is emptiness. The furniture can be brought in. There is space. You have not seen it that way. Otherwise, you would have come and told me that the room is complete. There is nothing. Only emptiness exists. The room is ready to receive anything. It has a space. Then you have looked at the positive emptiness. Look at the sky. The sky is a positive emptiness when there are no clouds. If you look at the sky as an absence of clouds, then you are looking at it from a negative standpoint. If you look at it as the presence of space, the blue emptiness, and out of that blue emptiness everything has arisen. So it cannot be negative. It is the most positive thing in the world, the very ground of being. Non-being is the very ground of being. Everything has come out of it, and everything by and by moves back into it. You are born out of it, and you will die into it. How can I know you? Knowledge will become a definition, and you are indefinable. No, I don't know you. I don't know myself. I would like to tell you one anecdote. It happened, and I love it, and I have been telling it so many times, millions of times. But whenever I remember it again, it is so new and so fresh. Bodhidharma went to China. The man who carried Buddha's emptiness in his hands. Bodhidharma carried the essential Buddhism to China. For the greatest phenomena to happen there, because of Bodhidharma, Laoists, whole Eastern point, the Laotian way of life and Buddha's realization met. And one of the most beautiful things was born. Nothing like it exists anywhere in the world. That is Zen. It is a meeting, a crossing between Buddha and Laozi. Bodhidharma was the midwife who carried the seed to the womb of Laozi. When he reached China, he was a very famous mystic. His name was known all over the East. When he reached China, the emperor himself came to receive him on the borders. The emperor asked few questions. He asked, "I have made many Buddha temples, thousands. What punya, what virtue I have gained?" If he had asked the same thing to any other ordinary Buddhist monk, he would have said, "Emperor, Lord, you have gained infinite virtue. Your heaven is absolutely certain, guaranteed." But he asked to a Ram person. Bodhidharma said, "Virtue? Nothing. On the contrary, you have accumulated much sin." The emperor was shocked. He couldn't believe. He said, "Why? What are you saying? I have made many temples of Buddha. I have published and distributed Buddha's sayings to millions of people. I feed every day thousands of Buddhist monks, and you say I have accumulated sin. What do you mean?" Bodhidharma said, "The very idea that you have accumulated virtue is a sin. It is very egoistic. Your hell is certain, emperor. You will fall to the seventh hell. The first won't do." The emperor could not believe. He felt a little anger also. And he said, "I have a question to ask. What is inside me? What it is that I am?" The same question that you have asked, "Do you know who I am?" Bodhidharma said, "A vast emptiness, a nothingness." Now the emperor was really angry. In anger he asked Bodhidharma, "Then who are you? Who is standing before me?" Bodhidharma said, "I don't know, sir. I don't know. How can you know emptiness? You can be, but you cannot know it. Knowing means you are separate from it. Knowing needs distance. How can you know yourself? If you know, then you are divided into the knower and the known. And of course, the known can never be you, only the knower. So whatsoever you know can never be yourself, the knower. And the knower is irreducible. It cannot be made known. How can you put yourself in front of yourself? You cannot. That is impossible. And if you can do, then that is something else which is in front of you, not you. You are always behind the knower. Always the knower. Always the knower, never the known. I don't know myself. And this is self-knowledge. It's paradoxical, but this is how it is. Nothing can be done about it. This is the nature of things. That's why a man of self-knowledge will never claim that he knows. Because who will claim? He becomes like an ignorant man. He says that I know only that I don't know. Move inwards. One day you will come to this emptiness, the hub of the wheel. The hub is empty, but it holds the whole wheel in it. The hub is empty, but without the hub, the wheel will disappear. It will fall into pieces. You have known only the wheel, that is your personality up to now. Your naam roop, your name and form, your wheel you have known. The deeper you will move within you, you will come one day to the hub, that is anatta, no self, emptiness. But remember again, it is not negative. It is not emptiness in the sense empty of something. It is emptiness itself. It is the most positive thing in existence. It is existence itself. Hindus have called it Satchidanand, Sat. It is Chit. It is aware. Anand. It is bliss. Remember, it is not blissful, otherwise it will not be empty. It is bliss, not blissful. You will not be filled by bliss. You will suddenly find you are bliss. Emptiness has the nature of bliss, has the nature of existence, has the nature of consciousness. Not that consciousness is filled in it. Not like a lamp burning in the room, so the light is filling the room. You can put off the lamp and the light goes. You cannot put off consciousness. It is the very nature of that inner emptiness, so not that it is filling it. You cannot destroy it. How can you destroy emptiness? You can destroy everything in the world. You cannot destroy emptiness. That's why you cannot be murdered, you cannot be killed. There is no possibility because you are not. The sword can kill the wheel, but the hub will remain intact. It cannot be destroyed. It was not there in the first place. Isness is the nature of the inner emptiness. Consciousness is the nature of the inner emptiness. Bliss is the nature of the inner emptiness. That's the fear people feel when they move into meditation. When they move into meditation, they become afraid. They start trembling. A deep inner trembling arises. A deep anxiety and anguish arises. Why it should be so? You are coming nearer to a blissful state, nearer to an alert, aware consciousness, nearer to existence. Why? You are scared of death. You are scared because you don't know how to be empty. You know only how to be filled. You don't know how to be empty. You don't know how to die. How to die to the personality? How to remain in the inner emptiness? You don't know. When you come inwards and thoughts start moving away from you, suddenly fear takes possession. Where are you going? You feel like disappearing. You feel like dying. A sort of non-existence grips you, as if you are standing on an abyss and you are looking down and it is bottomless, and you start trembling and perspiration pours from every pore of your body. Death is encountered. If you escape from this point, you will never be able to meditate. Hence, a master's need. So when you start getting afraid, he can persuade you not to be afraid. He can help you. Look at me. I have passed through this and yet I am. I have become empty and yet I am. And I am more than you. More than the whole existence put together. Somebody is needed to whom you can look to, into whose eyes you can glimpse the same emptiness that you are coming around within yourself, and yet you can see that he is totally and absolutely. So don't be afraid. His being gives you courage. His presence gives you courage. A master does nothing in fact. He is a catalytic agent. Just his presence is enough. Once you fall into that emptiness, you will start laughing. You will say, there is no death. I was unnecessarily afraid. Baselessly afraid. Passing through death, you become deathless. This much I can say to you, that you are a no-self. Become a no-self. And no-self is not empty in any negative sense. It is the greatest positivity. You said, second question, that you encompass all opposites in you, that you do not deny the sinner or the hate in you. In another lecture, once you said, you do not deny the devil in you, you are total. This puzzles me though. All I have ever felt from you are vast, vast reaches of love and compassion and a feeling of absolute goodness. When and where is your devil and your hate? When you are both, the devil is absorbed by the divine because it is a part of it. In fact, this is the inner arithmetic. If you live a part life, you will be devil. Because devil is nothing but a part claiming to be the whole. A part claiming that I am the whole. This is what devilishness is. When you accept it, it is absorbed by the whole. If you fight with it, then you will be fighting with yourself and you will always remain divided. In division, devil can exist. It exists in division. It cannot exist when you are whole and total. When you are divided, then in the cracks, it exists. It gets rooted in the cracks, in between two parts. When you accept everything, the whole life as it is, without denying, without renouncing, without calling names that this is bad and that is good. When you accept life as it is, whatsoever it is, whatsoever the case, when you accept it in its totality, devil disappears. It is absorbed by the God. It is absorbed by the divine. Devil is divine in the very word also. Devil comes from the same root as the divine. They both come from a Sanskrit root, div. Devil is divine. That is the root meaning of the term. Gone a little astray. But devil is divine. He has to be called back. And by fighting, you cannot call him back. By fighting, it goes away and away. And you will always miss a part. And that missing part will not allow you peace. It has to be called home. It has to be absorbed into the whole. If you accept everything, suddenly love flowers. Hate disappears. So when I say accept hate, I am not saying be hateful. In fact, I am cutting the very root of being hateful. When I say accept, in that acceptance I am cutting the very root. You will never be hateful again if you accept. If you don't accept, you will remain hateful. And your love will lack something. This has to be understood deeply, because it is not a metaphysical problem. It is existential. It is a problem that everybody has in him. You hate somebody. When you hate, what happens inside? What is the hate? What do you want to do to the other person? You want to kill him, destroy him. You want to throw him away as far away as possible. You don't want to see him. You don't want him to be near you. You would like as if he has disappeared, no more exists. That's why you want to kill and destroy. When you love a person, what do you want to do to him? You want him to be always and always alive, never to die, to be near and close, to be available. You would like to protect him, care about him. And you cannot believe that your love is going to be destroyed by anything. Your lover or beloved, you would like to be immortal. Look at the both phenomena. They are opposite. But can't you feel they are two aspects of the same coin? Creative is love, destructive is hate. But have you observed? No creation is possible without destruction. No destruction is meaningful unless it is for creation. So now, you can destroy if you are going to create, then there is no problem. You can demolish a house if you are going to create a better house. Nobody will say that you are destructive. You can destroy a society if a better society is possible. You can destroy a morality for a better morality. Nobody will say that you are destructive, because you are destined to create. And no creation is possible without destruction. Destruction is absorbed by the creation, then it is beautiful. Then it is part of the creative process. But you destroy. You destroy a society with no idea what you are going to do next, with no creative idea in mind. You simply enjoy destruction. You demolish a house. You destroy a thing. And if somebody asks why you are doing it, and you say simply, I like to destroy, then you are mad. Something has gone wrong in you. Destruction has become a whole in itself. It is trying to claim that I am the whole. When destruction claims that I am the whole, then it is devil. When destruction is part of a greater whole, creation, then it is divine. When you love a person, many, many times you will have to hate him also. But then it is part of love. A father loves his child. Many times he will be angry also. He will hit and beat the child also. And a child is never offended by anger. Never. A child is offended when you are simply angry without any cause. When you are destructive without any cause. When the child cannot understand why, then he cannot forgive you. If he can understand why, he has broken a clock. Now he understands that the father is going to hit him. And he accepts it. In fact, if the father does not hit him, he will carry the guilt, and that is very destructive. And he will continuously be afraid that someday or other it is going to be known that I have broken a precious watch or a clock or something. And the guilt will be there and the wound will be there. He wants it to be cleared with. He wants it to be finished, and the only way it can be finished is that the father becomes angry. Now everything is in balance. He committed something wrong, father became angry, he is punished, things are finished, he is clean. Now he can move unburdened. In the West, because of psychologists in this century, much absurdity has happened in the relationship between the parents and the children. And one of the absurd things that they have taught is that never be angry with your child, never hit him, never hate him. Because of this teaching, parents have become afraid. And this is something new. Children have always been afraid of the parents. In America now, parents are afraid of children. Something may go wrong psychologically, and then their child may be crazy, or go mad, or become schizophrenic, or split, neurosis, psychosis, something may happen in the future, and I will be responsible. So what is happening? But a father, if he loves the child, feels the anger. So what he will do? He will suppress the anger. And that a child can never forgive. Because when a father suppresses the anger becomes cold. Try to understand this. Whenever anger is cold, it is of devil. Whenever anger is hot, it is of God. A hot anger is beautiful, alive. A cold anger is deadly, poisonous. When a father really is hot, perspiring, red in face, and hits the child knows that the father loves him, otherwise why bother so much? But when the father is cold, sarcastic, not angry, but in subtle ways, sowing his anger, but in a cold way. The way he moves, the way he enters the house, the way he looks at the child, or doesn't look at the child. this coldness so that the father doesn't love him, doesn't love him enough to be heartily angry. And that has created the generation gap in the West, nothing else. Children have moved on their own. Parents have remained in a cold, dead emotion, imprisoned. A vast distance has appeared. There is no communication. A father cannot talk to the child because he is afraid if he talks, really communicates, becomes hot, the anger will come. So, it is better not to talk, avoid the situation, don't communicate. The same has happened between wives and husbands in the West, and now it is happening in the East, because in fact the East is disappearing. By the end of this century, the whole world will be West, there will be no East. It will exist only in the books of history, in museums. It will be a nostalgia, but the East is disappearing. It will be in geography, but in the human consciousness, East will have no place. What has happened in the West? The same, that if you love your wife, how can you hate her? If you love your wife, how can you hit her? If she loves you 24 hours, constantly. You are demanding impossible things. In life, everything is a rhythm. Only in death, things are absolute and there is no rhythm. In life, there is a rhythm. The day comes and the night. Says Heraclitus, God is summer and winter, day and night, hunger and satiety. Life and death. Life is a rhythm, a constant vibrating phenomena between two polarities. You cannot love a person 24 hours. If you try, the love will become dead. You can love a person intensely for a few moments, then you have to move because you have to relax. Otherwise, love will become such a fever and such a feverish state. How can you remain in it 24 hours? A day has to be followed by a rest, a night, a relaxation. Love is excitement. You cannot remain excited forever. You have to love. And you have to hate the same person. And nothing is wrong if you love. Remember, that is the point to be remembered. If you love, then nothing is wrong. Love sanctifies everything, even hate. Love purifies everything, even hate. Love makes everything holy, even hate. You love your wife and then you hate. She loves you and she hates you. And this makes life a rhythm. It is not a dead monotony. There are changes of moods, changes of seasons. And that change is good, because change is an alive phenomenon. Otherwise somebody loves you and loves you and loves you, even love will become a boredom and nobody can love you. Only 24-hour love can be pretended. Try to understand this. And if you pretend love, then you can pretend 24 hours, but then it is false. Only a plastic flower will not fade. Only a plastic flower will not die. If you are really alive, you will die also. That is part of life. If you really love a person, you will be angry also. That is part of it. And nothing is wrong in it. It becomes a sin only when it becomes the whole. If it is surrounded by love, the island of hate surrounded by an ocean of love is beautiful. It is beautiful. It gives tension to love, relaxation to love. It gives rhythm to love. It makes life a harmonious whole. Just think of a world where the sun never sets and you have to be awake 24 hours. Within 3 weeks, you all will go mad. And that is what has happened in love. You all have gone mad. Pretending, false faces, masks, hypocrisy, showing that which is not there. The real trouble is that when you are angry and you don't show it, by and by, this mechanism of suppression will become such deep-rooted that everything will become false. You will not feel love and you will sow. You will not feel compassion and you will sow. Then your life is not authentic, not honest. A honest life is river-like. It changes, it moves. Sometimes it is summer and the river has completely disappeared. Almost a dry bed is left. And sometimes it is rainy season and the river is in flood and breaks all the boundaries and flows all over, becomes oceanic. Just try to see, in life there is a rhythm between polarities, and humanity is caught in a trap because we have decided to remain on one pole. You cannot remain, you will move inside. Only on the surface you can try to pose. Then the whole life becomes poisonous. Then everything enters into everything else. In your love, hate is hidden. Because when there was hate, you tried to smile and pose. Now it is in your blood. When you love, it is mixed in it. Man now is an adulterated phenomenon, impure. And this has happened because of the wrong teachings of your so-called religions and moralists. They have all tried to make you to live on one pole. That pole they call God. Compassion, love, all that is good, all goody-goody. And another pole they call devil, all that is bad. Love say R.I. We are not in favor of this division, dichotomy. This schizophrenia. We are for both. And then a sudden transformation happens. Destruction becomes part of creation. It is. Hate becomes part of love. Love is bigger than hate. Creation is bigger than destruction. Life is bigger than death. And death should be a part of it. And if death is part of it, it is beautiful. Remember this, and then by and by you will see that even your hate has taken the color of love. Your destruction has taken the shape of construction, creation, creativity. Your anger has a compassion in it. Jesus was angry. Christians have not been able to solve the puzzle up to now, because they think that how Jesus can be angry? He has to be always smiling like a politician. How he can be angry? He was angry. He was deadly angry. He entered into the temple of Jerusalem, and he was so angry, he attacked, physically attacked the money changers. He must have been really tremendously angry, because he was alone and he disturbed many money changers, and he threw them out, board and all. He chased them out of the temple alone. When a man is really angry, he has the strength of hundreds. You may have also felt it. When you are angry, you can throw a big rock easily. When you are not angry, you cannot even move it. Anger is energy, concentrated energy. Anger is a deep concentration in being, one-pointed, whole existence forgotten. All energy is narrowed down to one point. Jesus must have been beautiful in that moment. Christians hide the fact. They try to avoid the story, because Jesus and angry. The man angry who says that if somebody hits on your one side of the face, show him the other side. This man angry looks contradictory. The man who says that if somebody snatches your coat, give your shirt also. This man and angry doesn't fit. But I say to you, only this man can be angry, and his anger will be part of compassion. Only this man can be really angry, because he knows what compassion is. He has known one pole, he knows the other pole also, and he can move. He is alive, he is not dead, he is not a fixed thing, he is not a thing. He is a alive movement, alive, throbbing. He can move to the other pole. And he threw those money changers out of the temple because of compassion. He was angry because of compassion. He was so compassionate. And sometimes I feel his compassion is deeper than Mahavir and Buddha, because it is so true and so lively. Mahavir and Buddha look more like wax figures. Fixed. Maybe it is because of the description of disciples. Maybe true stories have not been recorded. Because in India, the conception that a man of enlightenment cannot be angry is very old. It was not so in Jerusalem, because the Jewish God also can be angry. So there is no fear for an enlightened man to be angry. No fear. Even Jewish God can be angry. He behaves in a very human way. Jewish God behaves in a human way. Jain and Buddhist, human beings always are expected to behave like a dead god. Maybe that's why disciples edited the lives of Buddha and Mahavir. They have chosen parts and dropped parts out of them. That seems to be so. There are grounds for it to say so. There are two sects of jainas, two sets of Mahavira's followers, Sutambaras and Digambaras. Digambaras, in their life story of Mahavir, say that he was never married. He remained an absolute brahmachari celibate from his very childhood. And Sutambaras say that he was married, not only married, he had a daughter. Now, what is the matter? Why Digambaras say that he was not married? They are afraid that marriage is too human a phenomenon. Mahavir falling in love with a woman? No. That doesn't suit to their concept of a Tirthankara. Mahavir not only falling in love with a woman and getting married, but making love to the woman because a daughter is born. They cannot conceive Mahavir in a posture of intercourse. Impossible. They have simply dropped the whole thing because it is dangerous. Mahavir was never married. And Sutambara story seems to be truer. Why I say? Because if it was not the case, even Sutambaras won't aid it. If it was not already the case that he was married and a daughter was born to him, Sutambaras won't invent it. It is so against the rules, they will not invent it. So the only possibility is that the Digambaras have dropped the idea. And then later on, Digambaras dropped the whole idea of Mahavir's life. A life is a life. It is bound to have both the polarities in it. So Digambaras say that the real life story has disappeared because man in this age is not capable to understand it. So the original scriptures have disappeared. They are lost. There is no life story of Mahavir. They completely deny his life in this way. So you can make an ideal out of him. He is a wax figure. Not a real man then. With no human biography. With no human biology. Digambaras say that he never perspired. How can Mahavir perspire? This is ordinary human weaklings who perspire. How Mahavir can perspire? Never perspired. Looks foolish. Looks blind. This is how we fix things and then we try to make our ideas false ideas, then false personalities are created around it. Christians could not do it. They were not so clever. They didn't know it that later on it is going to be a difficult thing. Jesus' life seems to be more real, more historical. But then there are troubles. For me there is no trouble. For me this is how things should be. Only a Jesus can be really angry, but his anger is because of compassion. You think how he can be angry if he has compassion. And I say he can be angry only because he has compassion. Then compassion covers anger. Then it changes the very quality of anger. because it becomes a vital part into compassion. Once you absorb both, you have a different quality of your being. Hate becomes also part of love, anger part of compassion. Don't try to choose, rather remain choiceless and create a harmony. Become a harmony. Don't create any conflict within you. Whatsoever you are beautiful. You have all the ingredients to create a harmony. If you discard something, later on you will repent, because that discarded part someday will be needed. Someday you will miss it. You will see then that it was necessary. It was to be there, and I discarded it. Don't discard anything. Use everything that God has given to you. Make a harmony out of it. Harmony should be the goal. Third question, you said that just being in the presence of an enlightened master will transform. Before coming to you, I felt more or less independent. Since being with you, I seem to have become totally dependent on you. You are the light in my life. When I think of you leaving, I get into a panic. Is this a natural stage which will pass by itself, or is something wrong? It is a natural stage if you allow it to pass. If you cling to it, then something goes wrong. There are three steps in the spiritual growth. Steps are stages. They can differ with each individual, but there are always three. One is independence. There is an egoistic state. You want to be independent of all, which is false, which is not possible, because you are not independent. You cannot be. You are a part of this vast whole of this cosmos. How can you be independent? You have to depend on millions for millions of things. You have to depend for light on the sun, for life on the sun. You have to depend for life on the air, on the oxygen. You have to depend on the trees for food. How can you be independent? You cannot. That is an egoistic effort and is bound to fail. When independence fails, suddenly dependence arises. You move to the other pole. Because you don't know how to be in the middle and how to create a harmony, you move to the other pole. Then you become dependent. Then you become afraid that if the object of your dependence is lost, what will happen to you? Then there is panic. But this is the second stage. Independence is false, dependence is also false. Then there is the third point which has to be achieved, which I call the harmony. That is interdependence. A feeling of interdependence, that you depend on the whole. And not only this, the whole depends on you. I am reminded of a Jewish mystic, a Hasid mystic, Josiah, who used to say to God in every prayer that I know, my Lord, that I depend on you, but you must also know that you depend on me. I know that without you I cannot be. But let me remind you that without me you also cannot be. How can a God be there without you? Impossible. Scientists say that the plants, the trees, the whole vegetation on the earth depends on the sun. Without sun it cannot be. But now they have started suspecting that this is a one-way traffic. Must be somewhere wrong, because in life there are always two-way traffics, never one-way traffic. If the plants depend on the sun, somehow the sun must depend on the plants, because it is a mutual give and take. They have started suspecting, and sooner or later they will discover how the sun depends on the plants. Everything depends on everything else. You feel happy when you look at a flower, a rose. Your happiness is created by the rose. Now, scientists have proved that when you are happy, the rose also feels happy. He depends on you. He waits for you when you are coming. If you don't come, he is just like a lover, feels very sad. Now it is a scientific fact, not a poetry. Now it is absolutely proved that when a lover comes to the rose bush, the whole bush thrills, celebrates. It depends on you. Now they say that if you love the rose bush, it will grow faster. It will produce bigger flowers, because somebody is there to care and love and see, and somebody waits. How can the bush betray you? It has to produce bigger flowers. If nobody loves and the garden is neglected and nobody bothers, just servants come and water the plants without any care, then for what, for whom? The bush should try to bring big flowers, then small flowers will do. Even without flowers there is going to be no harm. For whom to flower? For whom to bloom? The rose bush depends on you. Never pass a tree without saying hello in the heart. Never pass a tree without looking it with deep care and concern. It costs nothing. And remember, if you can make a tree happy, the tree will make you happy. You can try the experiment, it is simple. Big scientific instruments are not needed for it. It is a simple experiment. You choose a plant, a tree in the garden of your house or in a public garden. Go every day to the tree, talk to it, become friendly. It is difficult to persuade the tree, because human beings have treated trees so badly that they have become afraid of all human beings. And the moment you enter, all the trees say, human being is coming. The most dangerous animal on earth. It can harm without any cause. No animal does that. If a cow is hungry, she will eat the grass. But a man can simply sit and go on pulling, for no reason at all. He is not hungry, he is not going to eat it. Why you are pulling it? Why you are destroying it? The inner destruction of the mind, inner destructive mind goes on being destructive. You pass by the tree, you pull a branch, and then you throw it. Are you absolutely asleep? If it is needed for food, then too, the old tradition in all the primitive societies says, the old traditional lore is in Mexico, in primitive aboriginal tribes in India, in Thailand, in many countries, that go to a tree. If you need something, ask her. You need few leaves, 5 leaves for your worship. You ask the tree, take permission. And pull the leaves as carefully as possible. Don't hurt the tree. And then the tree is always ready to give. And there will be no hurt feeling behind. And thank the tree that you gave me 5 leaves when I need it. Whenever you need something, don't be shy. Just tell me. Go to a tree, talk to the tree, touch the tree, embrace the tree, feel the tree. Just sit by the side of the tree. Let the tree feel you that you are a good man and you are not in a mood to harm. By and by, friendship arises. And you will start feeling that when you come, the quality of the tree immediately changes. You will feel it. On the bark of the tree, you will feel tremendous energy moving. When you come, when you touch the tree, she is happy as a child, as a beloved. When you sit by the tree, many things you will feel. And soon you will be able that if you are sad, come to the tree. Just in the presence of the tree, your sadness will disappear. Then only you will be able to understand that you are interdependent. You can make the tree happy and the tree can make you happy. And the whole life is interdependent. This interdependence I call God. Lao Tse calls Tao. This whole interdependence. God is not a person somewhere. This whole interdependence is God. Tao. Dhamma. Vedas call it Rit. Villa. Whatsoever you like to call it. Call it. But this interdependence is the whole thing. And if near me you can learn interdependence, you have learned all. First your independence will drop. That is not very difficult. Because independent you feel so burdened, you are always ready to drop the burden. That is not very difficult. Then you become dependent. That can be more difficult. Because burden thrown on somebody, it will happen. Then you are afraid. Then panic. Don't cling to it. This is a phase. Just like the first was a phase, this is also a phase. This is the reverse aspect of the first phase. Try to feel more and more interdependence. I am talking to you here. If you were not here, somebody else was here, even a single person was here, different, I would not have talked the same. It was impossible. Because I have no mind to talk. I am simply responding to you. You create the situation, you are here, and I talk. If somebody is not present here today, had he been present, I would not have talked the same. It was impossible, because his presence would have created a different situation. I am not talking in a vacuum, I am talking to you. And I am not talking from the mind, because when you talk from the mind, you don't bother who is there. You have certain things to say, you say. I had a teacher. He was really a philosopher. And he was such a crazy man, as philosophers are, that for years nobody would join his subject. He was eccentric. And it was impossible to pass in his subject. Because either he will give 100% or he will give 0. There was no midway with him. Either yes or no. He was absolutely Aristotelian. Either you are right or wrong, he used to say. Nothing in between. So students were afraid. But I liked the man. He was really worth watching, and that was the only way to watch him, to join in his subject. So I was the only student. And this was his way. The first day he told me that, remember, I can start by the bell of the university, but I cannot stop. Because unless I finish whatever I am saying, I cannot stop. So the periods will start with the bell, but they will never stop with the bell. Sometimes I will talk only 20 minutes and finished. Sometimes I will talk 2 hours or 3 hours. So if you feel very much fed up or bored, or if you want to go to the bathroom or something, you can go, but don't disturb me. And I was the only student. You can go and you can come, but go and come in such a way that I am not disturbed. I will continue. I tried for the first day. I was amazed that, is he really going to do it? Does he mean it? He meant it. When I left the room, he continued. When I came back, he was on. Then for 2 years, I was with him. Sometimes I will go for hours, because I have a habit to sleep. After 11:30, it is difficult for me not to sleep. So 11:30, I will go to my hostel room and I will have a sleep of 1 hour, and then I will come and he is talking. He was completely mad. He was really a philosopher. But I'm not talking to you that way. I'm not a philosopher at all. I'm talking to you. It is the interdependence. Whatsoever I say, you are responsible for it as much as I am responsible. Because you provoke it. You and I, these are just two polarities. Something between us is created. That's what is happening. When I am talking to you, not I am talking to you, not you are listening to me, we are talking to us. We are talking to us. This is interdependence. You are talking through me, I am listening through you. But this is the interdependence. Independence you have dropped, now drop dependence also, become interdependent. And this is just a learning here. Then let your interdependence spread to the whole existence. Feel interdependent everywhere. And you are. That is reality. Dependence is false. Independence is false. Only interdependence is true. Only God is true. God is interdependence. Fifth question, According to you, women are closer to the whole than men. How come so few women attain enlightenment then? Not so few. Exactly the same number of women attain to enlightenment as men. But they don't fuss it about so much as men. That's all. They don't advertise it about so much as men. They enjoy it. That is how women, the feminine being is. Men enjoys more talking about his enlightenment than enlightenment itself. He is interested how many people have come to know that I have become enlightened. Women are not worried. They are not worried at all. If it has happened, they enjoy it. They nourish it deep inside. It becomes a pregnancy. They live with it. They don't talk about it. That's why you don't know many names. Only few names are known, and those are women who had some quality of man in them. That's why you know. Otherwise you would not have known them. In Kashmir there happened a woman of the name Lalla. In Kashmir they have a proverb that we know only two names, Allah and Lalla. Lalla was a rare woman, a Buddha, but must have been not very feminine, must have been a little more like male mind than like female mind. She lived whole her life naked. That is the only woman in the whole world. Many men have lived naked. Mahavir, Diogenes, all the Jain Tirthankaras, and thousands. But only one woman. Looks very unfeminine. Because the very feminine mind is to hide, not to sow. To hide in the inner cave. But Lalla is known that she was an enlightened woman. Few women are known to be enlightened. One woman, Maitreyi, is known in the days of the Upanishads. But she must have been a very male type. It is said that the King Janak has called a great debate of all the learned people of his kingdom to decide the ultimate question, what reality is. It was going to be a great discussion, and all the learned people, all the pundits of the country gathered together, and there was going to be a great prize for the winner, 1,000 cows, the best of the country, with gold covered horns, with jewelry around their necks. They were standing there outside the palace, 1,000 cows. Whosoever is going to win the debate, he will take those cows. Yajnavalkya, one of the great learned men of those days, And at that time he must not have been enlightened. Later on he became an enlightened sage. He came with his disciples. He was a great teacher. And he was so arrogant, as scholars are, that he told to his disciples, "You take these cows, I will decide the matter later on. But you first take this cow because it is too hot and cows are suffering heat." He must have been very arrogant, so certain. Only ignorance is so certain. Wisdom is always hesitating. Because it is so vast. And how to decide the ultimate nature of reality? Who can decide it? All other scholars were offended, but they couldn't say anything because they knew that they cannot defeat this man in argument. In argument he was superb. And he argued. And he defeated all. Then a woman was sitting there. She was the only woman. And she has not said anything. She was Maitri. And then she stood in the end. When almost the debate was finished and he was going to be declared, she said, "Wait. I have to ask few questions." And she asked simple questions. But in fact, simple questions also cannot be answered. She asked, "On what this earth is supported? Who is supporting this earth?" As the old Indian tradition says, the earth is being supported by four elephants, or eight elephants, big white elephants. So Yajnavalkya repeated the old tradition that the earth is supported by eight elephants. "Are you absolutely illiterate? Don't you know this much?" The woman asked, "Then on whom those elephants are supported?" Now, Yajnavalkya suspected trouble. So he said, "On Brahma, on the God." And he was thinking that now she will stop. But she said, "I would like to ask on whom your God is supported, on what?" Yajnavalkya became angry. And he said, "Woman, stop. Otherwise your head will fall down. You will be killed." This woman later on became enlightened. But she must have been a very male type. She argued and even put Yajnavalkya into trouble. And in fact, she remains silent, but she was not defeated. Anyone can see. In fact, Yajnavalkya was defeated. If I was the judge, she has won. And the cows had to be returned to her. Because this is no argument to say that your head will fall down. This is no argument. Anger is no argument. Violence is no argument. This is, you can keep somebody silent, but you have not won the debate. This woman became enlightened, but this, she must have been a male type. Otherwise, no woman bothers to argue about such things. Once I asked Mullah Nasruddin that how things go between your and your wife, because I never see any argument. He says, "On the first day, we decided one thing and we have been following that and everything is going very, very good." I said, "You tell me, because many people come to me." for my advice about problems so I can suggest them. He said, it is a simple law. We have decided that on ultimate questions, final questions, great problems, my advice will be the final. And on small things, petty things, her advice will be the final. So I said, this is very good decision. Then, what problems you call petty and what problems you call great? He said, for example, which talkage we should go to see the movie? What type of food we should eat? What type of restaurant we should visit? Where we should send our children, to which college or to which university? What type of education should be given to them? What type of clothes should be purchased? What type of house and car? These are all petty things he decides. Then what are the great problems? He says, whether God exists or not. Great problems I decide. Women really are never interested in great problems because they know deep down they are foolish. You can decide whether God exists or not, or how many angels can dance on one point of a pin. You can decide. And Nasruddin told that this arrangement has been so good that not a single argument has arisen. I always decide great problems. She always decides the small problems, and things are going well. By and by, every husband comes to know that he is free only to decide metaphysical problems. Otherworldly. No woman is interested in writing scriptures they have never written. But that doesn't mean that women have not become enlightened. The same number. Life follows a proportion. It should be so, otherwise the balance will be lost. Life completely follows proportion. I would like to tell you one thing, maybe that may suggest you. To 100 girls, 115 boys are born. And this has been a problem for biologists. Why it happens? Always, 200 girls, 115 boys are born. And by the time of the age of marriage, 15 boys have died. So the proportion remains the same because boys are weaker than girls. Girls survive more than boys. So nature has a balance. From the very beginning, 15 boys as extra, spare, because they will die by the time the marriage season comes. 100 girls will be there, and if 100 boys are born, then only 85 or 80 boys will be left, and 20 girls will be left without husbands. That's not good arrangement. 115 are born, so that by the time the number comes to be the same. This cannot be solved. How nature arranges this? By what method? How this proportion? And then, in these two world wars, another problem arose, because in world wars, the proportion becomes very disproportionate. In the First World War, after the World War, in every war after the war, more children are born than ever. That too is something. In war, many people die. Immediately nature has to make arrangements. Some unknown force, some unconscious force goes on working. After the war, many children are born. But that too is not difficult because that can be explained in other ways. Maybe soldiers come back home to start for sex. They make more love. That may be the cause of it. But if that was the only thing, it could have been explained. But more boys are born than ever. Less girls are born. Because in wars, men die, women remain. More men die in wars than women, because all soldiers are men. So the ordinary proportion of 100 and 115 changes. To 100 girls, almost 300 boys are born. A subtle balance somewhere. In fact, for each man, a woman exists. For each woman, a man exists. They are part of one whole. Whenever one man becomes enlightened, one woman has to become. Because one man is freed out of existence. Now he will not be coming back. He will no more enter into the womb, into the world. Somewhere one woman has to be relieved of the bondage. So this is my reading, that as many men and as many women, the same, have become enlightened. But women are not known because they don't make a fuss about it. They enjoy it. The last question. You always say wait and see. Wait, I can understand. But how to see? You need not worry about that. You simply wait. And seeing will come to you. No need to worry about it. Waiting gives you insight. When I say wait and see, I don't mean that you have to do both. I simply mean wait and you will see. In fact, wait and seeing will come to you. Waiting creates seeing. Patience creates the possibility. Absolute patience creates absolute possibility to see. In tense, impatient minds, eyes are clouded, filled with a smoke. They cannot see. When you silently wait, by and by clouds disappear from the eyes, because they are created by impatience. When you patiently wait, they disappear. Vision is clear. A clarity is attained. You can see. Wait. And see, when I say this, I don't mean that you have to do both. I mean wait and you will see. Seeing will come by itself on its own accord. You simply wait. You understand me? If you can wait, that means you have dropped the reaching mind, the achieving mind. You have dropped the desiring mind. Only then you can wait. Waiting means now you are here and now. This moment is enough. This moment is all. Suddenly eyes are clear. No clouds roam in the eyes then. No smoke. The flame burns without smoke. And you see. Enough for today.